You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with George Waterman. He's calling me from New London, Connecticut. George, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Pleasure to be here.
So, George, I want to talk to you about the Visual Art Library, which for our listeners is visualartlibrary.org. It should also be accessed through the text on this website. But to begin with, can you tell me a little bit about what the Visual Art Library is and what your position is there in maintaining it?
Well, sure. The Visual Art Library is an effort to cover the art of the 20th century and the contemporary period from all over the world. We have somewhere above 60 to 70,000 books and catalogs now, many art periodicals going back to as far as the 20s in some cases. And it is my hope that we will be able to make this substantially larger than it is and to serve as a scholarly resource for the art of this period.
Tell me a little bit about how it started and how it's housed. I mean, it seems like such an ambitious idea. That's an awful lot of volumes, and obviously there's much more potentially to come. So how did this begin? And I'd love to know a little bit about the funding model, too, for this.
The funding model, that's a problem always. The I began in the 70s collecting art, and I collected a lot of the who were now well-known artists, such as Sarah and DeSouvre, Stella, and people like that, the West Coast artists, Irwin Terrell, and others. And then in the 80s, I decided that collecting art was a lot of trouble, because all the artists want to do is have the art shown as it should be, and so you had issues of insurance, shipping, and receiving. And anyway, I decided I was really more interested in the information about the art, so I decided to try and collect the information, and I began in the 80s, and then in 3 or 4 years ago, we formed a not-for-profit visualartlibrary.org, and I donated everything to them, or I am in the process of donating it all.
By donating everything, besides the periodicals, there was also, I mean, in all the books and information, what happened to the Serras and the DeSouvres and all the work that you were collecting before you stopped?
Some of them I have. Those I've sold, but others, other things I have. It is interesting, you know, as time goes on, to if you're really an avid collector, as I was in those days, where I knew most of the dealers and most of those artists because they were my age, you really can get the best pieces. And a number of those pieces are you know, worth a lot of money. Now I don't have them anymore. For example, I bought Richard Serra's most important early piece. It's the one he says got him up off the ground. It's called House of Cards, one-ton prop, done in 1968. And I bought it, it was in a show called Anti-Illusion of the Whitney. And I used to see Leo Castelli all the time, and I asked Leo how much it was. It was $3,000, and Leo said, well, I'll give you 10% off. And now that piece is probably worth, I don't know, I should think $4 to $5 million at least. I wish I still had it, but I don't. So I started with those artists, and but then I got into the idea that it was so much, all the art was so interesting, and to me, when you actually collect the art, you sort of run out of space pretty quickly. And when you collect the information, it takes up a lot less room. So I began to switch to doing that. So what I've done is to try and put together a collection of information I'm not necessarily collecting rare books, although rare books fall in from time to time. But I'm collecting the information and from all sources and in many languages. We have works in the Cambodian language, for example, one of the most beautiful written alphabets. So there's many different things that are here, and I hope that there'll be a lot more as we go forward.
Well, where do you begin and end? What's the scope of it? I mean, we're talking about all the visual arts all over the globe, in all the languages that sound that exist. So, I mean, this is something that potentially, I would think, would need double the space that you have, or quadruple. It almost seems there's no end to the amount of space that you might need.
There really is no end, and I just have to go as far as I can go. For example, a few years ago, I focused on the 20th century art of Croatia, and we have 300 or 400 books now on Croatian 20th century. You know, there were some wonderful artists in Croatia. So it goes like that. We have perhaps 200 or 300 books on 20th century Korean art. In fact, one of our advisors is a well-known Korean artist who was one of the early modernists, named Park Si-bu. We can't cover everything. You're right, it takes a lot of space. We already have almost doubled our space up here in the last 3 years. We're getting a lot of gifts from artists. The library was just given almost 900 books by a wonderful artist named Mary Lucier in honor of her husband, who passed away a few years ago.
Sound artist, right?
And visual. Yeah, that's right.
A composer, right, and visual artist, yeah.
Yeah. But in that particular gift, for example, there are books about the Nova Scotia School of Art and Design, College of Art and Design, which was very important to the art of the early 70s. And they're sort of hard to find, so I was delighted to see those roll in, along with more than 20 books on Alex Katz, who was a close friend of theirs, is a close friend of hers. So the books come from all sources. It's a question now of being able to fund the space needs, which are the least interesting but the most necessary. And then to be able to continue to receive these wonderful gifts. We've received maybe 600 or 700 books from another artist named David Reed, well-known painter, in the last year. And
sure, David Reed is very well-known. So what did David Reed give you? Were those also books on other artists, or was this like a portion of his library in general?
David has collected books for a long time, and he and I have often spoken about book collecting. There was a dealer named Nick Weiler in Los Angeles, a wonderful fellow that died much too young. And Nick collected books, and David and I often compared whether Nick's library was larger or mine was larger. And David was doing the same thing. Anyway, he ran out of shelf space, which is a problem everybody has. So he just had to lighten the load a bit, and he gave me one.
But it doesn't sound like you had that problem yet of running out of shelf space.
I don't have the problem because we have enough space at the moment, but we haven't got enough shelves. That's another part of the problem. We just added 3,000 linear feet of shelving, and we probably need 3,000 linear feet more to put everything up that we have now.
So I interrupted you, though, to tell me a little bit about what David Reed, what was in the collection of books that that he
Well, David gave us a lot of books. He gave us a number of books on Richard Prince, for example. He gave us a great many periodicals, very interesting periodicals, like October, periodical started by Roslyn Krauss, and Parquet, another wonderful one. So he gave us a lot of terrific stuff. I'm hoping to find a resource that has a lot of the earlier catalogs from the 50s and 60s. We have some, but nowhere nearly enough, and there aren't really that many around. Some of those artists, like Lois Dodd, who's a wonderful painter, who now is in her, I think, late 80s, she gives us quite a lot of things, and she was a member of the Tanager Gallery, one of the 10th Street galleries. She's given me quite a lot of stuff, quite a lot of material about the 10th Street, about the Tanager Gallery, which is most unusual. So this material is coming from many different sources, and the art world is a web of different connections. And we're getting these connections from all these different sources. Sometimes they connect, sometimes they don't. But all together, it's all about the art world of our time and of the 20th century.
And I would think there's no collection like this in the world that has this much in one place, or am I wrong? Is there other collectors, you must know them all, that have collections that are equivalent?
There's a collector in Germany named Egidio Marzona who has a great many books and catalogs, and he's a very nice guy, and he's focusing on the 60s also, and we knew each other slightly a while ago. I haven't seen him for quite a while, but he let me come into his library and take whatever I wanted, and I let him to take whatever he wanted from mine, so he took some 60s stuff for me, and I took books of early catalogs of Documenta, for example, from him. So we have.
How does that work? Does he have duplicates of those, or you guys just kind of swapped and takes? I would think you'd want to keep books you have, and he'd want to keep all the books he had. How do you determine who gets what?
He had duplicates of the Documenta catalogs. I didn't have duplicates of the things that I gave him, but that's okay. You know, none of these things are, by and large, most of these things aren't too expensive. It's simply a matter of finding them, and that's the hard part. Some of the books are expensive, but most of them aren't. It's just a matter of collecting. And so as to the size of the library, no, it's not the largest at all. The modern, when I last asked, Nylon Houston, the librarian there, how many books they catalogs they had, he said 310,000. So I would imagine that I've been told this is the largest, what was a private collection in the country, but I don't know. And then there's the Getty, and the Whitney's collection isn't particularly large. And so there are other places around the country, but probably not too many.
So let's talk a little bit about just approaching the building, how other scholars who may be listening to this can use the resource. Where is it exactly in New London, Connecticut, and how does one make an appointment to go there and use the library?
Well, New London is rather strategically located, in my opinion. It's right on the Amtrak line. The library is a block and a half from the Amtrak station, just up State Street. And in terms of people using it at the moment, one has to make an appointment, and not all of our books are on our catalog yet. We have perhaps 30,000 plus that are cataloged. and 30 or 40,000 that are not. So we have a lot of work to do, but those that are cataloged are certainly available by appointment, by email, and it's visualartlibrary.org. I guess it's info@visualartlibrary.org is the email. So we can certainly arrange for some people to, if they let us know what they're interested in, we can tell them how much is cataloged and is available of that particular subject.
And what is it? What building is it housed in? I mean, because a block and a half from the station, that's historic New London. That's not an area where real estate is inexpensive. What kind of building do you have, and how is it that you can expand in that particular area?
Well, in the 80s, I did quite a lot of real estate work in other parts of the country, and I had a house in Fisher's Island, which is just across the sound from New London, and two historic buildings became available on State Street, and I bought them both. It wasn't the wisest real estate investment, but I have a lot of space in these two buildings, and in one of them we have the stacks, which are now 2,500 or 3,000 square feet, and in the other one we have a lovely reading room that we have completed with a lot of general art books. So we're right. We're very accessible by train. We're only a mile off Route 95, so it's very easy to get here. And if we know what people are interested in, we'd be glad to see what we have that's available.
So you have these two buildings. Are both these buildings now nearly full? Do you need another space to grow, or is there still room within these buildings?
There's room to grow. I wish they were full, but there's room to grow in these buildings. And I would imagine that we'll grow fairly rapidly at the rate we're being given books.
How can there are many listeners here who may be interested in supporting it. They can certainly go to the website, but how is it supported? Can individuals give donations? Is there a development program, or how do you guys survive and keep the building heated? It seems like a kind of fantastic archive and library. How does it continue to exist in this day and age?
With difficulty. I'm hoping that out there in the world someplace is somebody that will say, this is a terrific idea and I'll give you whatever you need. We probably need, right now we spend very, very little, but we probably need about $500,000 a year to really make this one of the great art libraries in the country. That is to say, enable us to collect from all over the world and to make it available. So it's not impossible. I've just got to find that person with the resources that can support it. But people can give now Visual Art Library. It's a 501c3, so it's deductible. In fact, I certainly would urge anybody that likes the idea to consider that. One can find the donation form on the website, visualartlibrary.org, and that would be a wonderful thing.
It seems such an important resource to keep going. So George, I mean, before we go, this is kind of an incredible position you're in, manning this library. You've done a lot of different things throughout your life, and at this point you're working on this. You know, it seems to me like an enormously ambitious project that will go on. That's really also a legacy. In looking back on all of this. How do you think you arrived here? I mean, I know this is kind of an odd question, but you know, it's kind of a wonderful thing that you're doing. You were collecting art for a while. Did you ever imagine that you'd be working with this many books and working in this kind of capacity?
I don't really think I did. One begins to assemble and a library rather inadvertently, and then it becomes, then you find you have a great many books on Henry Moore, for example, but you're missing this one or that one, and so you fill it in and so on with Boyce and Brancusi and whoever it may be, you just keep going. I think there are probably 400 books on Picasso, for example. Well, Picasso gets rather boring after a while. I mean, enough is enough. But
well, there's always different editions, right? But I suppose, yeah. Of all kinds of things. So as someone who's spending his days in this library, is that what you primarily do, your activity? Are you reading a lot of these books every day? Are you flipping through books every day and looking at images of different artists and kind of immersed in that?
All of that, but I don't spend every moment on this library. I do other things as well, but I do spend maybe half the time on the library, I suppose. And I do look at these books all the time. I read some, but not all, of course. And it's a very interesting thing to me, all of this that is going on, and the different opinions and the different ways that art has developed, particularly in the last 20 years, 30 years.
Well, you've seen a lot develop in the last 50 years, from the time in the 70s when you were collecting artwork to when you sold some of it to the artwork that you still have. That was a sort of a sea change in the art world. That was a time where art went from something that really basically wasn't a commodity that could potentially reach, you know, get huge figures at an auction house, to becoming that. Richard Serra is a case in point for what you paid for that piece, and what it's worth now is kind of extraordinary. You've watched all those changes, and you've watched that happen with all the artists. I mean, how do you feel about that change? Is that something that seems exciting to you? Is that something that is detrimental, do you think, to the art world? But you've witnessed the whole sea change there yourself.
Well, yes, that's right. When I was first involved in the art world in the late 60s, mid 60s, and early 70s, I was fortunate to have known most of the major artists alive at that moment. Some of the abstract expressionists, Barney Newman was always at the parties, for example, and all of the major dealers, really, Leo and Dick Bellamy and Andre Emmerich, Arnold Glimcher. It seems to me that with so many young aspiring artists graduating from art schools around the country and around the world, that the possibilities for greatness have increased, along with the possibilities for a lot of art that is not very interesting. But if there's so many people that have started down this road, many more than started in the 40s and 50s, perhaps we'll see something dramatic come out of it. It's hard to really judge. For example, I've just been reading a little book by Alex Katz's wife, Ada, who is always seen in many of his paintings, and it's called How Artists Began, or When Artists Began, small paperback book printed in the 70s sometime. Very interesting about her interviews with artists of Alex Katz's age, Alex Katz himself, and Lois Dodd, others of that age who discussed how they became artists. It was quite different then than it is now. The GI Bill helped some of them. So things have changed dramatically, and I think probably if we can overcome the amount of art that we see and somehow try and sift through it and find those pieces of those artists that are totally sincere and totally able, that we will probably see the art develop in many different ways, as it has. We never had a video art, for example, or earth art. Oh, there were earth art artists, but they weren't called that then, or performance art particularly, or computer art. It's changed enormously.
Yeah, I agree.
The Skowhegan School of Painting and Sculpture, for example, is still called the School of Painting and Sculpture, but they do everything else as well, because they have to nowadays with the change of interest. Photography, there was not much interest in photography, even when I started looking at art. And it wasn't very valuable. Sam Wagstaff put together a collection without a huge cost and then sold it for a lot of money to Weston Neff, who was the curator of photography at the Getty. So these things change, and that's one that did change. So there's a lot going on.
There is a lot going on. And it's great to hear about the library, and I hope to visit it one day, and hope other people who are scholars or just interested in research would also reach out to the library and also perhaps support it. Before we go, I want to ask you, which seems such a curious question to ask you, and as opposed to everyone else that I ask, which is, what is it that you're reading at the moment? Is there, it could be off topic, not necessarily the art books, but it could be. You mentioned, of course, you're reading Alex Katz's wife's book. Is there anything else that you're reading at the moment that you want to mention?
Well, I've just been reading a book called The Last Art College, which is about the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design. It's a large book about what happened there, and so that's really my current book. And also Irving Sandler's recent book on his life in the arts.
George, I want to thank you for talking with me today. It's been a pleasure getting to know a little more about your library and the incredible collection you put together. Thanks so much for talking with me today.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.